Welcome to the 93rd episode of the Jamie Delaney Plant-Based Wellness Podcast. My name is Jamie Delaney, and I'm your host. I'm a plant-based cardiologist and endurance athlete living in Southwest Florida. Welcome. My dad once said to me, every day can't be a good day. And I might extend that this week to every week can't be a good week. And when I say that, it's not that it was a horrible week. It was more of just a probably not a win week as far as plant-based nutrition goes for me. And I really didn't add everything up, but I guess maybe that's just the way I finished off. So we'll kind of go through that. From a training perspective, my Ironman is 2 weeks in the rear, and I'm feeling good, back to running. I have a marathon, California International Marathon, December the 3rd, so I'm trying to kind of bump up the running miles slowly. A little irritation in my Achilles still from the Ironman, but it's getting better, so we're bumping that up gradually. So I'm trying to go the push the pace a little bit, and then one day really easy pace. So I'm trying to get back to that 80-20 running and stay out of that gray zone as I kind of bump things up, but really kind of taking it easy until, you know, my body's for the most part healed from the Ironman. As far as my backyard garden goes, last week we planted beans, eggplant, Swiss chard, microgreens, cauliflower, put some more peppers out. Tomatoes are still on the porch. So that's coming along. It's now I have a chance to go into the yard every afternoon and look to see what's popped its head up. We still have some vine spinach growing. I actually have a jicama underneath the ground that's starting to grow. Sweet potatoes are growing. The okra is still growing, and the poblano peppers are still growing, and we have this crazy hot pepper that's still growing. So that's all exciting, and that's going well. What I have to look forward to is the American College of Lifestyle Medicine Conference that starts this Sunday. So I'm anxious, again, to go into a room full of like-minded people that are whole food, plant-based, and see what's going on in that world as far as what people are doing in their offices and their practices. What are plans, what's coming around, how people's success are, so share stories and get ideas for the future. So I'll look forward to, in the next week or so, reporting back to what I've learned and any changes that I make to my plant-based nutrition practice as I learn more information. I had a medical student this week for 4 days. And it's been a long time since I had a medical student in my practice worked with a medical student. When I finished my training, I was on faculty at West Virginia University, and I had medical students, interns, residents. It's been a while. I teach, of course, my plant-based nutrition class, and I help with the Echo techs and teaching them different things. And of course I consider myself an educator when it comes to my patients, but as far as teaching, medicine to students, I haven't done that in a while. And I agreed to do it, thinking that it would be, fun and interesting. But I have a consultative cardiology practice, so it's pretty busy. I was sent a third year medical student. And so the first 2 years of medical student, you basically learn anatomy and physiology the first year, and then you start to learn some pathology the next year, and you learn a little bit of the pharmacology of medications. And then the third year, it's all clinical. And so although you've supposedly got to learn some history and physical taking skills during those first 2 years, it's not to the third year where you actually become involved in patients and patient care. And usually it's done in the setting of a hospital where the medical students follow the interns around. So you have third and fourth year medical students, interns, residents, fellows, and then attending physicians. But in this particular program in this area, the students are kind of left on their own to find rotations. And so it's kind of up to the motivation of a student to find whatever rotation and how they... it's up to them about how aggressive they are when they interact with doctors and patients. And it was a little bit eye-opening and a little bit humbling, and it made me think about a lot of things. You know, again, going to medical school and learning about the body and learning about diseases, people become, you know, you're very interested and very excited to finally get to clinical medicine, to be able to treat people. Maybe another word would be do things to people, you know, as procedures and look at different things. So it's kind of overwhelming to put that all together. You've went from a perhaps quiet time and where you a lot of book learning and keeping your mouth shut to now all of a sudden you have to be asking all the questions. And I experienced firsthand just how bad this can be for a student. And, you know, because there's so many, you know, the typical, you see a patient and then you come up with what you think's wrong with them and you formulate a treatment plan. And, you know, the way it is for medicals, you know, in medicine today is that treatment plan is either a procedure or a pill. And so the medical student gets no training as far as the role of nutrition in all of this, either how nutrition caused it or how nutrition might fix it. And you can see that with all the overwhelming number of medications they have to learn about and the diagnosis and putting them together, nutrition is a way in the rears as far as, you know, being taught or even being considered in the treatment plan. Because the idea is to, you know, fix this problem quickly. We want to make a diagnosis, come up with a treatment, and get this patient healed and move on to the next one. So there's no thought about nutrition whatsoever. And frankly, I kind of understand how there's not much time to actually talk about nutrition when you have to do all these other things in the standard practice of traditional medicine. And it was interesting that even my student, when he came back from lunch smelling of fast food, he complained of belly pain later one afternoon. And, you know, he tried to make a diagnosis on himself. And he thought he might have a hiatal hernia. And I kind of giggled to myself. And it's like, no, it's probably just the Burger King and the fried onions that you had that's causing your belly pain. But again, you know, it goes back to, you know, what's in the book or what's in WebMD or what can you look up? And it doesn't really ever come up with what nutritional problems could have caused the problem. So, you know, it's a big problem. You know, I hear talked about, you know, how we need to train doctors to add nutrition into the practice of medicine. And really, I mean, I agree with it wholeheartedly, but the question is when and how. You know, certainly I spoke to my medical student about my practice of plant-based nutrition. And when he went in the room with me, you know, I always talk to my patients about what they ate and with regards to their plant-based nutrition regimen, how much salt they took in, how much sugar they took in. But that's, you know, that's really that's something that he's never taught as far as, you know, to take that kind of a history. So the reality of it is, if you were going to put that any place in the medical curriculum, it almost have to be a little bit of nutrition fundamentals in the first 2 years. And then the fourth year, leave it to the student to take a rotation with someone that was interested in nutrition. Because I think that's the only way they're ever going to get it. And it's kind of a shame because that's going to, you know, really limit the amount of doctors that are in, you know, you have to have an interest in nutrition to pursue an elective in nutrition-based medicine. And I, you know, I can remember way back many moons ago in my limited amount of nutrition training during medical school, there was an older medical student that was actually vegan. I didn't know it at the time. I just thought she was kind of a hippie. And I've since met her in the last several years and realized just how, you know, ahead she was or right on she was. But, You know, she was actually harassed a little bit because she asked the question, you know, about the nutritional aspects of brown rice versus white rice. And basically she became as known as the, you know, the brown rice girl, you know. And so she was harassed over that. And I never forgot it. And especially when I eat brown rice, I always think of her. When the medical student comes upon the clinical scene, they're often, you know, bedazzled by drug reps and medications and lunches and, you know, again, scopes and knives. And, you know, convincing them that greens and beans might be a great alternative is not going to be very easy. So you're almost left with a doctor that's, you know, been out in practice for a while and starting to see that traditional medicine is not really working, or that a doctor's been out in practice a while and starts to get sick and sees his or her own health failing and comes to the epiphany and then starts doing some research on the benefits of whole food plant-based nutrition. So I'm anxious to talk when I go to the Lifestyle Medicine Conference this week about, you know, that particular problem, because, you know, plant-based nutrition, you know, you can see how it becomes, or it remains a very secret to health. I think a lot that it has to do, as far as, you know, doctors that have been out, you know, I heard someone talk this week too, a little bit about, you know, taking your medicine. We talk about medicine compliance, and the reality of it is when patients are given a prescription, a lot of them don't even refill the second prescription if they filled the first one. And people that have to take a medication more than once a day don't usually take it accordingly, or a lot of times miss the afternoon dose or evening dose. And if they have to take it three or four times a day, you know, almost forget it. It's very difficult. And so we have these patients that are on these multiple medications. And you can, and so we talk about, you know, well, they weren't complying with their medicine, so it's not working. And a lot of times that leads to a lot of side effects, because doctors assume that patients are taking their medications how they were prescribed, and they're not. And then there's, you know, they're not working, so they just add on more medications. And so if there's ever a day when people take everything, then they can actually get into trouble and feel bad. And of course, then the next thing that happens is they're not going to take all those medicines because they felt bad. So they start picking and choosing or eliminating. And so, you know, we talk about medical compliance, but the same thing goes for nutritional compliance. You present, you know, if, you know, the best intention physicians that are trying to add nutrition into a patient's treatment doesn't have a whole lot of time to explain a whole food plant-based diet to them. And without the patient doing a whole lot of legwork and listening and reading and really getting into it, the compliance of the whole food plant-based diet is not going to be certainly 100%, but it might not even approach 50%. So the best you're going to get is maybe a change over time. And so that is going to result in not as good a result as to somebody that, you know, would have went on a whole food, plant-based, no added oil diet. And oftentimes people will come in and say, well, you know, it's not working. Haven't lost any weight. My blood pressure's still high. My cholesterol's still high. So this way of eating doesn't work. I might as well just go back to my regular way of eating. But the reality of it is they weren't taking the nutrition prescription as it was prescribed. So if, you know, they took their nutrition prescription one day and stayed home and ate oatmeal and blueberries and walnuts and flaxseed and salads and 4 cups of greens and no added oil, and then the next day they went off the, what I call the reservation, and had Egg McMuffin and Subway sandwich and chilies for dinner, then they have this, so they had this tremendous backfall. So not only did they, you know, have a horrible day, they probably undid what they did, you know, the day before. So, you know, it makes prescribing nutrition, you know, really difficult. You're going to have to spend a lot of time with people to help them transition. You know, there are a lot of days, you know, so we have the cheat days, and then there's so many confusing factors as far as the not seeing what's, you know, the hidden labels. I had a woman in nutrition class that, you know, had a big salad that had broccoli and kale, and then she put the poppy seed dressing on it that came in the bag. And what was in that? Well, I don't know, you know, so she didn't look. So she had this great salad full of antioxidants and then, you know, dumps most likely 80% oil on top of it. And, you know, plus adds up all these, you know, all the extra calories. So that good day wasn't quite as good as it could have been. And then the next day is not a good day because she wasn't plant-based and, you know, she's not making any progress. So, you know, it is a bit of a difficult situation. And, you know, while we're on the subject of my nutrition class, well, I guess, yeah, we'll go to the nutrition class this week. So it was the second session of my six sessions. And so I had a couple of new people that either didn't make the first class or, you know, or just coming with their spouses. And one of the first questions I got yesterday was, well, what about lard? And I was kind of shocked. This person was involved in a landscaping and fruit trees club. So you would think there's a little bit more of nutrition. She's like, well, my neighbor grows organic pigs. And so we kind of, you know, went back through what we learned in the first class as far as endothelial reactivity with the intake of lard and, you know, the saturated fat and lard. And, you know, this organic word that is used so easily, you know, anything from, you know, coming up with a great idea, being doing something organically to growing food organically to organic butter, just because it hasn't been associated with pesticides or organic. And, you know, organic can mean just living. So it can, there's a variety of interpretations, but it certainly doesn't mean healthy all the time, for sure. So, you know, and I look at, the, you know, so I had the lard question and we have the poppy seed dressing question of one couple that are doing well, that have, you know, transitioned. They kind of described themselves as three leaves, although never quite made it to a full plant-based dinner, you know, doing so great and then threw a piece of salmon on top just for fear of that they, you know, it was just there or didn't know what else to put on the plate. So it's going to be a big challenge this session. And I think one of the biggest challenges is getting people into the kitchen. I brought my Instapot in this week and we did a potato leek soup and started with celery and leeks and carrots, a little bit of miso and then the potatoes. And so the idea was to show people just how easy this electric pressure cooker is as far as making soups. And we talked about other things that could you make in it, rice and potatoes and, you know, to do things quick and to make your life easy, because I've got to get people back into the kitchen, especially early on, to get them to learn what they're eating and to really, because you can't, if you go out, you have no idea what you're going to get. At least if you're home, you can read labels on that poppy seed dressing and see that it's 80% oil and not, and try to figure out how to make it without the oil. So we did that, and then I did a kale salad with some avocado, lemon juice, walnuts, and craisins. And again, most people hadn't had a kale salad or, you know, are a little bit worried about the texture of kale. So the avocado makes it a little bit more palatable early on for people, you know, by massaging the kale with a small amount of avocado. It makes it much more tender. The avocado gives a little oil feel, but it's still, you still have the phytonutrients, you still have the fiber. And, you know, Dr. Esselstyn is completely no oil, but I think in this case, if you can limit the amount of it, given that it's not a free processed oil, I think it's a good compromise to get people going in the right direction. So, we have a ways to go. There are some people that are doing well and trying new things. The other struggle that I had this week was people that you know, trying to keep a diary of what you eat, and it's a pretty difficult thing in some respects to really be true to it, especially if somebody else is writing the diary down for you. I prefer to see the kind in a notebook that's kind of written down. I don't care if it's scribbled, what you put in your mouth. But one person's diary, you know, I mean, a lot of stuff are missing, you know, and so it makes it very difficult to kind of troubleshoot. But you know something's wrong when things aren't getting better, yet the diary looks good. So, you know, one thing is the ghost portions. And you know, even if the ghost portions are more bread, you know, more pasta, that could be an issue, or there could be oil snuck in someplace. But, you know, often there are these ghost things that people just don't realize. Oh, you know, one patient cooked her son collards with bacon, but she didn't eat any. Well, you know, so you're cooking a meal for your, you know, if you're going to cook collards for your son and collards and, you know, greens for yourself, and you're supposed to eat greens, chances are you're going to maybe not eat the bacon, but you're going to eat the collards with the bacon grease. So you're not really, you know, where you should be. And, you know, even that wasn't even on the list as far as her diary. So that made it for a difficult week as far as the office trying to sort things out. On a positive note, I had the Chamber of Commerce in my office for a bit of a ribbon cutting for a plant-based nutrition practice. And I served the Tuno, which I posted on Instagram, that's made with sunflower seeds and dulse flakes and a little bit of soy sauce and lemon juice and some white beans on red cabbage. And then I made Dr. Furman's oat balls, and I kind of twist that recipe around a little bit and add craisins to some of them, and I did pumpkin with some of them instead of a banana. So I had that out on a table, and it was amazing how people were a little bit afraid to come right in and try. They, you know, tried the oat balls first and liked them okay, and then, you know, went back and finally we talked about it and tried the Tuno, and they all actually liked it, but it's not something that they would have picked up by any stretch of imagination on their own, except for an ophthalmologist that came over that was actually plant-based. So that was great. I got to know him, and we're going to try to do some work with plant-based nutrition and also seeing how it impacts glaucoma and macular degeneration and some of the diabetic changes in the eye. And that's been documented before in some papers. A lot of the diabetic eye changes because of the microvasculature, the small blood vessels, actually will improve on a whole food plant-based diet. And again, it's hard for me to believe that somebody that had eye problems that all are associated with loss of vision would not readily adopt a whole food plant-based diet if given the opportunity to save their eyesight. But, you know, again, it's something that's not talked about because, you know, right, if you have eye problems, you just get a laser treatment or eye drops and you go on your merry way and things are okay. Or, you know, you have to have a laser procedure and that's just part of it. But it doesn't have to be. So, but that was, it was good. And hopefully we'll get some people thinking because of that and maybe get some referrals in to take the nutrition course. You know, a lot of my colleagues, we talk about, you know, the improvement in disease. This is nearing towards the end of Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And if you watch football, you see the people with the pink ribbons and the on their hats and pink towels and pink socks and pink gloves. There's kind of, you know, pink everywhere. And it's really frustrating to see that, you know, even on the pink yogurt container. So, you know, the dairy is going to increase the risk of breast cancer, and nobody talks about that. And, you know, everybody looks at early detection, and we really haven't, you know, a new study came out that, you know, early detection is not helped with these big aggressive cancers, and that early detection may only pick up small, what we call ductal in situ carcinomas that really weren't going to do anything to start with. And, you know, again, we're much better off decreasing the incidence of breast cancer from the get-go. Some early detection, you know, methods are, you know, associated with increased morbidity and even mortality from procedure infection and unnecessary procedures and perhaps unnecessary treatment. So, you know, wouldn't it be better just to prevent the cancer in the first place? When you looked at, when we go look at cardiovascular mortality, there's a, I pulled up on our website in the hospital, I just put in heart disease and diet and looking at risk factors. And a study came up from 1975, and it showed a decrease in mortality since 1975 to 1990. That the cardiovascular disease has declined by 24% to 28%. That's cardiovascular deaths. But they said since 1990, that rate has actually slowed. Well, 24% to 28% is not very much since 1975. And then there was another review that said that 50% to 54% of cardiovascular events were due to cholesterol, high cholesterol, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and smoking. And it basically said that most of these deaths were due to cholesterol, diabetes, hypertension, obesity, and smoking, and the 50 to 54% were actually preventable. Well, I don't know, but if, you know, I think, again, hopefully plant-based diet, since it's never brought up, but it certainly will prevent hypercholesterolemia. It'll prevent diabetes, obesity, and you can stop smoking. So, you know, I think to say, in respected medical literature, that 50 to 54% are preventable shows just where we are as a medical community with our head in the sand from a nutritional standpoint. There was the Inner Heart Study looked at 52 countries, and they associated 9 risk factors being accountable for 90% of the risk for a heart attack. And they were smoking, cholesterol, high cholesterol, hypertension, diabetes, obesity, and then they had this broad category of psychosocial situations. And again, these are all reversible causes for the most part. And in the Nurses Health Study, 120,000 nurses followed for 20 years showed an 84% reduction in all cardiovascular events if they weighed normal, had a good diet, meaning low fat, and exercise, and didn't smoke. So again, now you're up to 84% reduction. So I think, you know, again, as a medical community, we have to get our head out of the sand and say, you know, well, these things are really preventable. If you have 5 risk factors for cardiovascular disease, you have a 10-year risk of an event of 25 to 30%. And that was in the Framington Heart Study of 5,000 people. So, you know, I mean, so we know these things cause disease, and the reality of it is we just have to wake up and realize that they're preventable. I titled this discussion, you know, is it the fruit? And fruit comes up a lot as far as people that are diabetic, you know, can they eat fruit? Or people that aren't losing weight, oftentimes they'll blame the fruit, or they'll blame the fruit for their sugar spikes, or they'll say that they don't eat fruit because they are a diabetic and they're not allowed to have fruit. And, you know, it's the funny part about it is most people didn't eat a whole lot of fruit before they became diabetic. So how's the fruit going to cause it to be worse? But there was a study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition in 2012 where they took a glass of water and they added 3 tablespoons of sugar, which is equal to the amount of sugar in 1 can of soda. And if you look at somebody's blood sugar spike, it's within an hour of drinking that. And then there's this giant fall in their blood sugar because you have this big insulin release from the pancreas. And because you have all this insulin in the system, then the blood sugar actually falls really low. And your body thinks that it's starving, so you have fat release. So then you have this surge of triglycerides in the blood. So now you have high glucose, which is, you know, and then high fat, which is very toxic to the blood vessel wall. So they repeated the experiment adding berries to this. So they took sugar, water, plus berries. And interestingly, that blood sugar spike wasn't even as bad as it was without the berries. And, you know, despite the berries have some calories, and they certainly have fructose. And there wasn't the following dip in the blood sugar, the low dip. And there was no release of fat into the bloodstream. And they repeated that experiment using white bread and berries, and they had the same thing. The blood sugar didn't go as high, and it didn't fall. It didn't have that big low dip, and there was no increase in fat. So the question was, why did that happen? You know, was it the fiber, the phytonutrients in the berries? And even when they did it with juice, they had a similar result. And it turns out that when you take in sugar, it's so toxic to the body, you have what we call these release of free radicals. And, you know, just as bad as it is as bad as it sounds as far as free radicals. So they're like little time bombs that are released from the metabolism of this free sugar. So your body's antioxidants, your body has to fight these off. And you spend a whole lot of time fighting them off. But if you take in blueberries or the berries, you actually, because of the phytonutrients, actually protect the body by blocking the uptake of the sugar from the intestine. So, you know, it's the sugar in the fruit there, the fructose doesn't matter as much because it's surrounded by all these great properties in the phytonutrients. Same thing happened if they ate cornflakes. You have a lot of free radical release. But if you added a half a cup of blueberries to the cornflakes, it was markedly improved. They've also shown that eating a piece of fruit with each meal will block the glucose spike. Again, probably because the phytonutrients block the increase of uptake of the sugar, the free sugar from the colon. So, you know, certainly a piece of fruit with each meal, that's not a problem. And they looked also at, you know, two servings of fruit versus no servings, two servings of fruit versus less than two servings of fruit in diabetics. And they had much better control of their diabetes with the two servings. They also showed you know, better glucose and blood pressure control. So what would be the toxic amount of fructose? And it's been determined that the toxic amount of fructose is about 50 grams. Well, that would be, you know, four pieces of fruit. But it's also, teenagers typically get 75 grams of sugar in their system a day just with the sugary drinks. But it turns out that if you take the fructose in the form of fruit, up to 20 pieces of fruit a day, your blood pressure will drop, your cholesterol will drop, and there's no big spike in sugar, and there's no increase in sugar control. And actually, there was weight loss in 20 servings of fruit a day, and no change or spike in the triglycerides. And, you know, I've talked about it before. Fruitarians that eat fruit and green leafy vegetables, for the most part, you know, their diabetes is unheard of. So, you know, I encourage my diabetic patients as well as my patients alone to eat fruit. Now, that doesn't mean canned fruit. I had a patient come in this week, and, you know, they were eating canned fruit and fruit and syrup. You know, that's not where you want to go. But fresh fruit and, you know, frozen fruit, you know, that's fine. And I encourage people to eat that as to decrease their sugar cravings. You get this, you know, so once you started eating fruit and you find fruit that you like, it helps a lot with that snacking. My favorite fruit this time of year are persimmons. They're in season now, and so I've been eating at least one persimmon every day is one of my fruits, along with my berries and banana that's usually there, and various other things. But I really like the taste of persimmons. I never had one until the last couple of years, and I really look forward to them coming in season. You know, We know that apples, 2 apples a day is going to decrease your cholesterol. Add that. So, you know, add that as your medicine. It's certainly better than a statin if you can get your cholesterol down with fruit as opposed to a bunch of medications. So instead of snacking on, and I had somebody come in and they were doing sorbet. And, you know, sorbet is very sugary, you know, especially sorbet that you purchase. It has a lot of added sugar into it. So eat the whole fruit because you're getting the fiber from the fruit as well as the phytonutrients. So it's much, much better to get, you know, that extra fruit in a day. So I guess if you're listening to this podcast and you have high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, a family history of heart disease, maybe a history of breast cancer, prostate cancer, or have had that, then you need to look at food as your nutrition and food as your medicine. And you need to follow the exercise prescription. I don't think anyone would try to take the wrong, and they would be very upset if they were given the wrong dose of chemotherapy. Or not enough blood pressure pills, or not the right dose of cholesterol. And nobody wants side effects from any of the medications. So if you look at nutrition that way, then we need to eat the right amount of greens and the right amount of fruit and eliminate the stuff that's going to cause us harm. So I would encourage people this week to kind of look at what they eat and keep a food diary. And see just how many nutrients they are getting in versus things that counteract those nutrients. And again, if you're someone that goes out a lot or think about that you're putting your health in somebody else's hand to give you your medicine. So if you get food from a drive-in window, you're getting your medicine prescribed by a 16-year-old kid that is heating up some sort of fat-laden, chemical-laden meal for you, or somebody in the back of the kitchen who is indiscriminately putting oil and salt on something because it'll cover up the taste of maybe not a great cut of whatever, or maybe not the freshest vegetables. So really don't leave your nutrition in the hands of those people. And, you know, with regard to the social aspect of that, leaving your nutrition hanging in the balance of peer pressure is similarly the same thing. If your friend decided to tell you not to take your medication because they weren't going to take your medication, let's put that again. If your friend said, don't take your medication because I'm not going to take my medication today, you probably wouldn't do it. If they told you not to take their medication, if they told you to change the dose of your medication, you probably wouldn't do it. But you're willing to have your nutrition compromised because your friend wanted to compromise their nutrition. So if you thought about it that way, you might be more inclined to stick to your guns as far as, you know, you can have the peanut butter mud pie, but I'm choosing not to because I know what that's going to do to my blood sugar, my cholesterol. You know, I'm not going to have the salty thing because my blood pressure won't take it, and I desperately don't want to take the medication. So that may be a good way to look at things and to gain more of a perspective. There's no one that's going to look out for your health more than you can. I guess on the last note of today, I tried a new vegetable this week called chayote, C-H-A-Y-O-T-E. In some people call it chocho. There's a variety of other names. It is in the cucumber zucchini family, South American, Asian descent. It's a round type of fruit that has a pretty high, or I'm sorry, round type vegetable that has a fairly high water content. And so it comes in, there's a green one, a green variety, a white variety, and then there's a prickly variety that has kind of, looks like little prickles on the outside of it, or, you know, it's like a brush type of texture to the outside of it. So I got a green one and a white one, and I got it home, And I cut it up on Sunday. And actually, when I was at the grocery store buying under the farmer's market, there was a Puerto Rican lady there. And I said, how do you fix it? And she said, well, all right, and what does it taste like? She said, well, it really doesn't have a whole lot of taste. And I was kind of, you know, it's like, oh, you know, I'm not sure how this is going to go. So Sunday night, I decided to make it. And I chopped it up and took a bite of it. And I really couldn't tell a whole lot of difference between the white and the green as far as flavor. And it was pretty... I guess there wasn't a real distinctive taste to it. A little bit like a jicama, a little bit like a zucchini. It had no seeds in it, like a zucchini, and it was more watery like a jicama. I guess maybe, you know, more, I guess a little bit more on the line of the cucumber. So I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it exactly. I was going to make a salad with it at first. And it's like, well, it just doesn't really have that much taste. And it's going to be, you know, just kind of a fibrous, chewy type of substance. So I decided to do it in a pan with a little bit of water and garlic and a poblano pepper. And I did feel the frustration of cooking a new vegetable. And I thought, you know, geez, that's probably a lot like... some of my patients that are cooking vegetables for the first time, that they're kind of frustrated that they're trying to make dinner and they want people to like it, but they're not sure how it's going to taste, and it might be disappointing. So I made it, and turned out it was good, you know, with, again, I did poblano pepper, garlic, and just sauteed it with a little bit of water. And we had some pink rice with that and some other vegetables. And it did turn out good. Oh, we had roasted Brussels with it, and so it turned out being a good vegetable. But I felt the frustration that you know, again, you might feel if you're cooking vegetables for the first time. So I guess, you know, give yourself a break. You know, you might not like all of them, but a little hot pepper or a hot sauce can go, or a little soy sauce can go a long way to help things, to give it a little bit of flavor. If you need to, but try to add a new vegetable into your routine, you know, every week or so, just to try it, even if it's part of a stir fry. I encourage people to try, you know, bok choy. There's baby bok choy in stir fries. It's a real good sweet, you know, taste, as opposed to the cabbage, as being something different. You know, try putting... using the red cabbage leaves as like your taco shell for some salads, whether you make tuna with sesame or tuna with sunflower seeds or beans, perhaps. So, you know, try some of those combinations to see if you like them as a change. And, you know, again, I believe that getting outside is huge. The days are going to start getting short, and the vitamin D is going to start to go down, especially if you're in the north. So get outside and enjoy the days while you can. In Florida, we're finally starting to get some cool mornings, and it's been great. You know, I'm seeing hawks on my run, and you hear the birds, and the sun's coming up. It's nothing to, you know, it really starts your day out good by getting outside. And I encourage everybody to get outside for even if it's 10 minutes in the morning, just to kind of see the sun, feel the air, you know, and just walk around a little bit. We even saw a bobcat on our run this week, and walked up right out and kind of ran in the road right out in front of us, coming into my neighborhood. And at first I wanted to stop and take a picture, and then I wasn't quite sure whether I should. I had the dog with me, whether, you know, it might have decided to become a little bit aggressive, but it wasn't. So, I mean, it's so nice to start your morning seeing some nature and some animals, and even if you're in the city, just to get some fresh air and see the sun come up. So I think that does a tremendous amount for your psyche and starts the day out right, gets you a little bit of quiet time with nature. So I'd encourage you to do that. And I look forward to speaking with you next week, and I hope your week is good. And so eat your plants, eat something new, stay true to your nutrition, and get out and get some fresh air and sunshine.